This is what should be done.
By one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace, let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those sitting near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. When we come to meditation, and then once we've kind of got the fundamentals of the practice, really we're needing to develop a peaceful mind, because when we have peace in our mind, then we can sustain our mindfulness. And you know, if we contemplate a lot, then you know, we have to come back to the peace in order to be able to sustain our mind. So peace is kind of like the foundation. So if we look at our mind, if we're getting agitated or getting involved in things unnecessarily, we just have to see if that's a good use of our time. You know? So we have the actions by the three doors, actions of the body, actions of speech, and actions of the mind, actions of thought. And you know, this is where our practice is. This is what mindfulness is. It's training the mind to know what it's doing and the quality of those actions and to improve them. And when we're foolish, to have enough wisdom to know that we're being foolish. You know, I think it says in the Dhammapada, a fool who knows he's a fool is wise. So at least you know that much, that those actions are not good, that, you know, that's not a good thing. And meaning, you know, we can't always solve all of our problems. We're not going to be perfect to begin with. And, you know, the enlightened masters following after the Buddha, they had to perfect themselves as well. It didn't come overnight. You know, nothing instantly occurs. You can't get an oak tree in a day. And so the same is with our spiritual practice. But, you know, without having a teacher, without having wise spiritual friends, it's easy to get stuck in our old habits and old ruts. It's easy to, you know, get lost in the world. And the days pass by. One of the reflections for the monks is, you know, the days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? And for the lay people, I mentioned several times the five recollections. And so that's, you know, old age, sickness, death. I am the owner of my karma. One. And the all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. And then so the bhikkhus have, the monks have those five, but then another five. And one of those is that one. And that's a great line, you know. The days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? Because, you know, yes, death may come tomorrow, but the truth is, you know, we can lose a day. We can lose a week. We can lose a month. We can lose a lifetime. So, you know, what is it that we're wanting to do with our lives? You know, is our sense pleasures and the things we're involved with, how important are they really? You know? And so the Buddha would even teach, you know, lay people, even though you have sense pleasures, you know how to have a mind that, you know, doesn't cling to these things. So if you're involved with them, there's several layers to the practice. But after being a Buddhist, you learn basically how to meditate, how to have sense restraint, how to have precepts, how to have generosity. Because all these things go against the grain of the world. The grain of the world is, the way of the world is delusion. It's spiritual darkness. It's just, you know, following after all the pathways the mind can create. It's bunwa, it's crazy. And so our job is to establish our minds in peace. You know, and whether we can only get drips of peace or we can get profound peace, ultimately it doesn't matter, because the purpose of the peaceful mind is to develop wisdom. But wisdom is what will break us free. Obviously, if we're really earnest, then eventually, you know, we're going to need at least periods of time where we have deep practice. So if people can't practice in their daily life, then, you know, going to retreat centers or, you know, getting some friends and having a retreat weekend, or, you know, telling your family, you know, this weekend, you know, I'm just going to be meditating and being peaceful. I'm not going to talk much. Because without stilling the external environment, if we're not doing it on a daily basis, how are we going to foster an environment for the mind to become peaceful? How are we going to deepen our samadhi, our strength of mind? And it's so easy. I mean, look at our personalities and some of the traits we had as a child. We still have them now. You know, our personalities are very, very, very strong. They don't go away easily. So we have to know these things. You know, what are our old habits? What are our tendencies? What are our weaknesses? And then we have to guard against these things. And for example, if somebody talks a lot, what's the quality of the speech? You know, and so the Buddha, I was saying on the Sunday, the Buddha for speech, in the Jatakas, had a simile of the chariot. When he was a Brahma, he came down out of compassion and spoke to a king who had wrong view. And he showed him the hells and then showed him the heavens. And then I gave him the simile of a chariot. Because he was a king, he thought for his temperament that would be a beautiful simile. And in there, I always remember, had the rattling of the car. It's like idle chatter. You know? So that's like, idle chatter is when we're just rambling or we're just talking about, you know, this, that, and the other, all unimportant things. And, you know, it's a form of pleasure. And so it's not that, you know, in the world, people have these things. And this is probably the main form of communication for a lot of people. But the point is, when we're meditating, you know, that tendency leads to thinking a lot. So when we're meditating, part of our peace is starting to teach our mind that peace is a good thing. And to teach our mind that peace is a good thing, we have to see that renunciation is a good thing, nekama. And nekama is the intention to renounce the sense pleasures. So you have pleasure of sight, pleasure of sound, pleasure of smell, pleasure of taste, pleasure of touch, you know, skin or internal. So they're our main field of experience, and these things arise, and then we create thoughts about them, we have memories about them, and we have imaginations and dreams about them. So these things obsess our minds. And so when we come to meditate, if we don't know how to still these contacts, if we don't know how to have sense restraint, then these things are just going to be crazy, boom, why, they're just going to invade our mind. And so instead of getting peace, now we're going to get lost in our old habits because we're going to believe all the stories of our mind. And so this is why to develop peace, we need mindfulness. And, you know, it's good to start with having a meditation. I recommend having a meditation in the morning and in the evening as a way of starting and ending the day, for example. Because this is a time when, you know, instead of being tired and, you know, just wanting to go to bed at the end of the day, we can learn to give ourselves, have a bit of energy, you know, learn how to brighten the mind and then do our meditation. And then in the morning, the same thing, start the day with some energy, start the day with some meditation, and then maybe even another period of the day where we stop. And that's like a minimum, you know. I found it difficult when I started as a layperson to have a regular practice, so I focused more on mindfulness. But looking back at the struggles over the years, I think, you know, having a regular practice is important. So if we can't do that, we have to look at why. You know, and often the reason is we're not giving it enough importance. We're not seeing, you know, the danger of existence. We're not seeing, you know, the death may come tomorrow, that all the things that we're working and living for and being involved with, they're temporary. They have a big label on them that says, may disappear soon. And yet we get lost and infatuated with them. So if we don't make time to develop our spiritual practice, develop our spiritual perfections, develop our watchfulness of mental states, watchfulness of actions, then, you know, who's going to do it for us? You know, nobody can eat for us. So nobody can practice for us as well. You know, you don't make a big dinner and then give it away every day, you'd be dead pretty soon. And same thing with our practice, you know. So if we just read the books and listen to talks and occasionally dabble in meditation, you know, we're not going to get that steadfastness in our practice. We're not going to have that resolution building. And but at least when we do have that regularness in the practice, we can start to see what the shortcomings are. You know, like if we are tired, maybe we should eat a little bit less. You know, if we're thinking a lot, maybe we should talk a little bit less, restrain our speech, or see what we're actually talking about. If we're, you know, have thoughts about the future or or fear arising, and we need to look, investigate what the cause of that is. Or just like one of my main meditation objects is the Buddha, because the Buddha is an excellent being. And, you know, and it's the first of the contemplations because it gives inspiration, gives enthusiasm. And if you learn a little bit about what the Buddha went through to become the Buddha, I mean, he really went through a lot. And, you know, so it really pales in comparison to whatever we may be experiencing. So that's why it says in the Dhammapada that the Buddha takes the difficult path. And very, very few Buddhas that arise in the long course of samsara on each planet that's inhabited. And they're very rare beings. And, you know, the power of the Buddha's mind, I can't remember exactly, but, you know, if you took this world system and then, you know, went larger than that and maybe 10,000 world system and then larger than that, like 10,000 of them and then larger than that, 10,000 of them, you know, that's the size, that's the power of a Buddha's mind, that it could encapsulate all of those beings' minds. You know, so it's incredibly powerful. There's actually a sutta somewhere where the Buddha says it exactly. I can't remember. But the faith of Ananda was so great that, you know, he believed this. And neither in that sutta or another sutta, the monks were talking down about that. And the Buddha said, oh, don't talk down about that because of Ananda's faith. You know, he would be, you know, if he wanted to, he could be reborn as a wheel-turning monarch for 7 lifetimes. He could be reborn as a high deva for 7 lifetimes. So the power of faith in the Buddha is really, really excellent karma. And I'm just saying that from my own practice. So, and wherever people are at, and whatever their beliefs are, the point is, if we want to practice, we need to know why we're practicing. And so in Buddhism, you know, we have the Four Noble Truths. And so the first noble truth is that there is suffering. And as Ajahn Chah said, that the suffering that arises in practice, this is the suffering that takes us beyond suffering. So, and just think, like, it's kind of like kicking up a storm, you know, when you're getting going with something. It's really difficult. It's really difficult. But that effort that we put in, once you get in motion, then things get easier. So this is why, you know, we build the causes up slowly, and we need wisdom to be able to sustain those causes. But if we don't have something like inspiration in the Buddha and, you know, a reflection of the sufferings of existence, then, you know, we're just going to get lost in our daily lives. And then whatever patterns that we have from the past, we're just going to continue that way. You know, but, you know, the houses that we live in, one day they'll crumble away. And they won't exist. They'll be pulled down or they'll be burnt or something will happen to them. But they're temporary. You know, the jobs we have, maybe those jobs don't even exist in the future. You know, or maybe the human race, you know, dies out or changes planet or whatever. It's like these things don't matter to the level that we think they do. But because, you know, we need to survive and we need to work and, you know, we've got all these daily things that we have to do, we get lost in the habit of doing, you know. And so the tendency to do is a great danger. And so this is why, again and again, with the great Ajahns, they teach us mindfulness. And where is our mindfulness directed? It's directed in our action. Our actions of body, our actions of speech, our actions of mind. And so before we do an action, we can contemplate. While we're doing an action, we can contemplate. After we can do an action, we contemplate. And the power of the peace that we develop, that will enable us to have moments of wisdom arise, where we can see clearly things that have happened in the past, or we can help prevent tendencies from arising in the future. So this is where we use the power of our peace to change the course you know, that we're on. And change lines, change train tracks, come back to the present. You know? And when I teach meditation a bit recently, I talk about the asavas, you know, relax the body, relax the eyes, don't flow off to the asavas. So the asavas are the outflows into the world. You know? So whenever the mind goes outside, that's suffering. Goes out to a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, a touch, a thought, worries about the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind, you know, attaches to any consciousness or cognition itself. All these things come with attachment and suffering. And so when we meditate, we just try and empty ourselves, you know, empty ourselves of these attachments, and just apply ourselves to the Buddha's teaching, apply ourselves to our meditation. And whether it's difficult, feels like it's not working, or, you know, we've got a busy mind or whatever, then we just keep applying ourselves. And then if we can't do it, then we seek help, we get advice, we find another way. Because, you know, whether we get a little bit of peace or a lot of peace, we need that peace. You know, so we meditate for 20 minutes, and you only get 2 minutes of peace. Well, good. That's 2 minutes of peace you wouldn't have got if we hadn't have done the 20 minutes. You know, so the thoughts themselves aren't a problem. And we don't know what karma we've done in the past. You know, we don't know how much spiritual parami we have. But if we don't practice, we don't watch our mind, and we don't develop mindfulness during the day, then we're developing a very slow path of practice. And so it's important to, you know, I like the mantras. I've always used mantras since I started practicing. So just when I started, it was Buddha. You know, or another one, I use Tatcho. Tatcho means skin. And so, interesting thing about Buddha or Tatcho, so Buddha means Buddha, like the awakened one. It also means awake. It also means like the one who knows. It's like waking up. So whether you use the Buddha and you repeat it mentally, or you use it with the in-breath and the out-breath, so use it as your formal meditation object, and you can also use it during the day to help prevent the mind from getting lost. But if there's no inspiration in your meditation, then you can contemplate it. Oh, what was the Buddha? You know, what does being awake mean? You know, what, you know, why is the Buddha called the kinsman of the sun and the great sage and you know, all these epithets? And so you use your mind to contemplate that object until you're interested in your meditation, then meditate. Because if you just sit down and do what you did yesterday without any aspiration, inspiration, enthusiasm, clarity, luminosity, then, you know, it's a slow way of practice. And, you know, the Buddha recommends the swift and easy, the swift and happy path. And that means we need vimamsa, we need a little bit of investigation, a little bit of making sure things are balanced, things are working properly. Because when we have that, well, it's difficult until we have clarity in our practice to see, but it's like, it's just like parenting a child, you know. There's certain things that need to be done for the child, you know, both to have acceptance and love, and both to grow in discipline, and to learn the things that are necessary for them to learn. And so we just look at our own practice, we look at the things that we need in order to grow in the practice, and we make sure that we nurture those things. You know, because if the seeds are planted and tended to, they'll grow on their own. We don't have to worry about that. So we don't worry, you know, if we've got bright lights or we've got peace or we've got anxiety or whatever it is that's arising. No, it's just impermanent. But the most important thing is being consistent with our practice. And, so whether we, however we set up our schedule, our days, we just see that, you know, if we died today, you know, what would have been more in purport? And doing more work, you know, more sense pleasures, more this, that, and the other, or what would the power have been of developing our mind more, developing our mindfulness more, developing our metta, compassion, mudita, upeka, developing, emptying ourselves of attachment. And these things are frightening to the untrained mind, but they lead to peace, because the peace of emptiness is supreme. But we don't know what emptiness is to begin with, because our minds are so full of attachment. But we just have to realize, imagine if we died today, you know, we would have to deal with all of those attachments. So at some point, we're going to have to deal with these things. And so that's why it's important to develop a peaceful mind and to practice, because, you know, death may come tomorrow. So we have to learn to give up the thoughts of the past, the thoughts of the future, and we look at what's arising right here now. And it's not that we don't plan for the future, and as lay people, you can still have, you know, your sense pleasures and these things in moderation. But without that sense restraint, without the strength of peace, you know, how will samadhi grow? You know, how will wisdom grow? And I was going to end with a quote from Lumpur Tet Ajahn Tet. That's the page. Page 3. The practice of meditation by Ajahn Tet. From Only the World Ends. The practice of meditation is nothing other than this same training of bodily action, speech, and mind. Whatever method is employed to develop samadhi, it must encompass the training of these three things together for it to be authentic Buddhist meditation. Virtue, samadhi, and wisdom deal solely with these things. Whether one speaks of the threefold training of enlightenment or of nibbana, one is compelled to speak in terms of body, speech, and mind. As long as one is dealing on the conventional level of reality, right up to the final relinquishment of the body and mind by an arahant, it is inevitable. The practice of meditation, take up Maranasati, the recollection of death, as the preliminary subject. Consider death. One day or another, I am bound to die, because all life is ended by death. When I die, I will have to abandon everything. Even the things that I love and cherish, I will have to leave behind. The use of the recollection of death as one's preliminary meditation subject is the consummation of all skillful means. Both contemplation of the breath and the meditation on unattractiveness eventually merge in death. Having contemplated death, one does not linger on anything at all. All that remains is the mind in solitude. It is exactly that process which is called cleansing the mind. That's enough. So, you know, these are powerful things. So when I speak about the recollection, the five recollections, which I've mentioned several times, and these are the purpose of our meditation, because, and even, you know, one of the recommended meditation objects, so people can't find they meditate, even though it's difficult initially to contemplate death. I remember one of the first meditations I had on one of the body parts on the heart, it was difficult. So I ended up learning elements first before I learned the body parts. Because the purpose of the body parts for a Buddhist monk is to overcome lust. And the purpose of, like the example, the skeleton is overcoming conceit. Because if you see a skeleton crumble to dust, what, you know, are you that dust? You know, what are you frightened about? And so, but the point is that usually our mind doesn't have the power to think these things. So we just wait till we die and then have to deal with these attachments. But why I mentioned particularly, you know, this training of body, speech, and mind and recollection of death is it's a very, very skillful means. You know, so whenever the mind doesn't want to do its meditation, when it doesn't want to do mindfulness, then we can use recollection of death. And yeah, maybe it takes a week or two for the mind to get used to it, but then these things actually develop very deep peace in the mind. You know, so that to begin with, they might be frightening, but you know, just can like make it a mantra, like we all die, that's for sure. You know, death comes to us all, or you know, life is promised to no one, or whatever it is, and just repeat that, you know, for 10 minutes or something. Sit down quietly and just repeat that. And that will both be samatha, developing peace, as well as developing samadhi, because you're doing the same thing again and again. And then if the mind gets lost, then you can contemplate it. So this is just an example of, you know, a way of training the mind, particularly if it's being stubborn, but also it's an excellent meditation object. It's one of the 40 recommended by the Buddha. And as Lumpur Tate said in this book, you know, it's a supreme meditation object, which a lot of the others are actually pointing to. And I mentioned the story of a lady the other week, I think it was at lunchtime, I'm not sure, and she contemplated death for 3 months at the time of the Buddha and became enlightened. And so, you know, these aren't small things. But the reason we don't want to contemplate it is because we're attached. We're attached to our body. We're attached to our loved ones. We're attached to the world. And so it's frightening to the mind. And it doesn't want to see these things. You know, but, you know, are we the food that we put in our mouth? You know, are we the water that we drink? When we go to the toilet, is that us? And when we breathe in, you know, are we that in-breath that now has gone into our bloodstream? When we breathe out, is that us leaving us? So, you know, there's these changing elements here. And so when we start to see it's our delusion that attaches to a label, you know, my name is Kasapa. You know, this is this person. And they've always been like that. Even though they look different as a child, they're exactly the same person now. And that will be the same in the future. And when they die, that will be terrible. You know, I'll be very sad. And where did these ideas come from? You know, who told us to think like this? So it's all coming from our attachment. So that's the Dhamma talk this evening. And we'll do a meditation. Okay, please set yourself up in a comfortable meditation posture. Set up the idea like we're on a secluded island in our own heart, an island of Dhamma. Give up the whole world. Even all the beings in this room, we set up the intention just to be as silent as possible. We're not going to disturb anybody. We're going to try and maintain inner stillness as much as possible. Just if you have some preliminaries, start with your preliminaries. Just relax the body. Ensure the body is relaxed. If you find that you get a bit dull in the meditations, then try and lengthen the spine a little bit. Try and hold a better posture. Sense of uprightness inside. You make that the mainstay of the meditation. Relax the eyes. Give up the tendency of the mind flowing out. You know, sights of fake, sounds of fake, smells of fake, taste fake, touch fake, thoughts fake, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind states, all fake. Don't believe any of it. Something arises, just label it as fake. Stamp it with fake. Maybe we then bring up some inspiration, enthusiasm, and the qualities of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Never come here to harm or hurt anybody. Just come here to develop bhavana and to cultivation. We have our clear aspiration. Now it's the time to bring up our meditation object, such as the in-breath and the out-breath, or Buddha, whatever our chosen theme that works for us. Make sure we've settled into our meditation. Have a good attitude, have a good mental state. We just apply ourselves to the meditation. Even if storms come, just let them pass. Just like a bird snug in the nest, we don't worry about anything. I'll be silent for the next 22 minutes. Just do our best to be with the meditation. see how we nurtured our mindfulness, our means for keeping with our meditation. Anything that we can learn, anything that we should know to help us with our practice in the future. We try and take this peace and keep it as a foundation as we open our eyes to end the meditation. Continue being peaceful and mindful as much as possible to our next meditation. That's the end of the meditation. Chant the verses of sharing and aspiration. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life, may they soon attain the threefold bliss, and realize the deathless through the goodness that arises from my practice, and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nirvana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of beliefs, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Yatavarivaha pura pare parenti sagara evangevaitorinam petanam upagapatir chitam patitam tongham kipaneva samichitu veprentu sangapa chandopanaraso yata manichotiraso yata savityo vivachantu Aparoko ina sattu mate pavantvantarayo sukhiti kayuko pavahapiva nanasili sanichan utapachayino chataro namma vatanti ayuvano sukhan.
Okay.
Have a good evening.